Wednesday, February the 4th, I'm Matt Wells. On the podcast today, a week before Israel goes to the polls, a preview of an election cast in the shadow of war.
Rockets are still being fired out of Gaza, and that's clearly quite a big problem for the Israeli government, which said that the whole point of this devastating three-week war was to stop the rockets.
Balancing the Holyrood books, Alex Salmond battles to get his budget through a second time.
If Salmond can't get it through a second time, his government would just have to resign, plunging the Scottish Parliament into its worst crisis in its 10 years of existence.
Plus, how to predict the future in a nine-week course. That's all coming up. First, the news and a paper review with Sandy Waugh.
Much of Britain is returning to normal today after the snow. Most schools are expected to be reopened and people are returning to work. Train services and airports should be able to end delays. But a 16-year-old girl has died after a sledging accident in Rother Valley Country Park in Rotherham yesterday. She was one of four girls injured when their makeshift sledge, made out of a piece of metal, crashed into a fence containing barbed wire. Another girl is still in hospital. Union leaders will discuss a proposal today to end the wildcat strike at the Total Oil Refinery in Lincolnshire. The Industry Conciliation Service, ACAS, which chaired talks between unions and employers, said the offer could soon be put to a mass meeting of the workforce. Union sources said the offer was to give half the new jobs on the disputed contract to British workers. The dispute involving a contract using Italian and Portuguese workers caused a spread of sympathy strikes around energy plants, including the nuclear station at Sellafield. The Immigration Minister, Phil Wallace, has said the government's considering new restrictions on skilled foreign workers coming to Britain. He said that the 400,000 graduates leaving university this summer could find getting jobs difficult. The minister told The Independent he wants to tighten a point system controlling migration of workers into Britain. The US president has warned that his economic stimulus package should not be protectionist. In a TV interview, he said he didn't want any provisions to trigger a trade war. Yesterday, the EU ambassador issued a warning over the clause, calling for any new construction in the stimulus plan involving buying American. President Obama has also admitted he screwed up in trying to appoint two cabinet members who've had to withdraw after admitting problems about their tax affairs. Obama's chosen a Republican, Senator Judd Gregg, to be his new Commerce Secretary, saying they didn't agree on every issue, but they did agree on the urgent need to get business and families back on their feet. In Scotland, First Minister Alex Salmond's making a second attempt to get his budget accepted by the Holyrood Parliament. After a week of tough negotiations, the minority Scottish Nationalist Party is likely to get the bill through. We'll hear the full story later in Guardian Daily. Still plenty of snow pictures on the front pages of the papers this morning, but also reports, as The Guardian puts it, of fury over school closures as weather eases its grip. The Mail says it was the fault of town halls who overreacted and closed 8,000 schools, which were frozen out by Elf and Safety. The Telegraph said that parents and business leaders reacted angrily and that teachers must show grit. In contrast, The Guardian reports that the holiday company Pontiac is recruiting 2,000 new staff, the famed Bluecoats, because recession-hit Britons are going to stay at home for this year's summer holiday. The Times believes that President Obama could offer cuts in nuclear warheads in talks with Russia, and The Mirror reports that Carol Thatcher's been axed for gollywog jibe by the BBC. The sports pages all tell how Arsenal bought St Petersburg star midfield footballer Andrei Arshavin right at the end of the transfer window, but The Mail says that a storm is brewing because the paperwork and the decision were late. The Independent says suspicions have been raised over the rushed deal. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Just weeks after the devastating assault on Gaza, Israel is going to the polls. Voters are being asked to elect a new government, and the opinion polls show a shift to the right. Will a change in government next Tuesday mean a new approach to the conflict with the Palestinians? Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Rory McCarthy, points out that rockets from Gaza are continuing to land in Israel.
Yes, rockets are still being fired out of Gaza, and that's clearly quite a big problem for the Israeli government, which said that the whole point of this devastating three-week war was to stop the rockets. Over the last few days, there have been a number of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza, and I expect that those will continue as long as the rocket fire continues. Israeli government officials are saying that, you know, until the rockets stop, Israel, you know, maintains the right to to retaliate and to launch airstrikes in Gaza.
And of course, Israel goes to the polls next Tuesday. I wonder what the political consequences of all of this is. Who's looking likeliest to become prime minister, do you think?
As far as the opinion polls show, it's probably going to be Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the leader of the opposition party, the Likud, which is the main right-wing party in Israel. Now, he's been in a good position in the polls for many months. It's not purely a result of this war in Gaza. I think he's ahead simply because there has been a solid shift to the right among the majority of Israeli voters over the last few years. And if anything, the war in Gaza has reinforced that. At first, when the war first began, it was very popular, and it did seem to improve the political fortunes of particularly the defense minister, Ehud Barak, who heads the Labour Party. His standing really did increase quite markedly at the beginning. Zippy Livni, the foreign minister, who is head of the Kadima Party, that's the main centrist party, hasn't seen such a great increase in the polls. And I think as the war drew on, particularly after it ended and yet the rockets continued to come out of Gaza, I think that sort of surge in popularity has dropped off a bit. And it's Netanyahu who still remains probably head and shoulders ahead of the others.
He's said to be the candidate least favoured by President Obama's administration. Will there be any consequences? Will it make negotiations, presumably to be led by the US, more difficult?
This is slightly difficult to call. I mean, certainly on paper, Netanyahu has made it very clear that he doesn't in any way embrace an immediate return to, you know, serious peace talks with the Palestinians. His argument is that you can't trust the Palestinians to make a peace deal, and he doesn't want to give up large amounts of territory on the occupied West Bank. His argument is that there should be what he calls an economic peace, which by which he means economic development, investment in the West Bank, in the hope that eventually that would create a situation where you could have a peace deal. So on the surface, that does seem to set him up at odds with an Obama administration that has said very clearly it wants to aggressively pursue a peace process in the Middle East. And yet, when Netanyahu was prime minister in the late 1990s, he did take some more pragmatic decisions. He withdrew Israeli soldiers from large parts of the West Bank city of Hebron, much to the consternation of the Israeli right wing, particularly of the settler movement. And so that shows us that even though he is a right winger, he can take pragmatic decisions. And we'll have to see what kind of pressure, we have to see, first of all, if he wins, what kind of a coalition he can put together, because he's never going to win enough seats for his party to rule alone. And then we'll have to see what sort of pressure he comes under from Washington.
Rory McCarthy there. You can watch a report on the Israeli peace movement by The Observer's Peter Bowman at guardian.co.uk/Israel. Also on our website today, is the weather finished yet? Find out at guardian.co.uk/UK. And the BBC's in hot water again, this time over remarks made by Carol Thatcher. Check out that story at guardian.co.uk/media. The First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond, will make a second attempt at getting his budget through the Holyrood Parliament today. His last attempt failed when the Lib Dems joined Labour in voting it down, prompting talk of a snap election. Our Scotland correspondent, Severin Carell, says the stakes today are high.
If Salmond can't get it through a second time, his government would just have to resign, plunging the Scottish Parliament into its worst crisis in its 10 years of existence. That would leave the Labour Party with the task, the unenviable task, of trying to form a ruling coalition. And this would be deeply, deeply unpopular politically.
It was looking last night as if a deal had been reached. What has Salmond had to do to try and get the budget through, do you know?
Well, very little. This is the most surprising thing. John Swinney, the Scottish Finance Secretary, is adamant that the budget bill they're going to be presenting tomorrow, and the budget bill, by the way, which is now likely to be voted through all three stages in less than 2.5 hours, has had no significant amendments to it whatsoever. What Swinney and Salmond appear to have done is just simply clarified some of the ambiguities that were surrounding funding for some of the Green Party's demands for a home insulation programme, and also Labour's demands for new money to create 7,000 2,800 new apprenticeships. But Swinney yesterday was saying that he didn't feel that there was anything particularly different in this budget bill at all. So what has changed for Salmond and for all the other parties, I think, was the shock of the defeat last week. The belief now is that when Labour voted against it last week, Labour didn't actually expect the Lib Dems to follow them. They thought the budget would narrowly get passed and that Labour would look like honourable opponents, but they wouldn't be left in the position of being the party that could be arguably the one that killed off the budget and all that new investment and extra jobs.
Is this just a Holyrood story, Sav, or does this event demonstrate a wider ebbing away of support for the SNP?
It doesn't as such. It demonstrates the fact that the SNP's power is quite delicate. I mean, its grip on power is quite delicate at the moment. It demonstrates that Alex Salmond's government is more fallible than Alex Salmond would have us all believe. And it also demonstrates, and this is an important message for people that are watching the next general election for the UK government, that coalition and minority government can be a very, very difficult thing to make work. What Salmond did, and this is the biggest issue for the SNP internally, is that he gambled and pushed things too far. He is a risk taker, naturally, and he took a risk with the Greens. John Swinney admitted last week that he assumed that the Greens would back them, and they were proven wrong, and the whole thing came tumbling down. What was in Salmond's favour, however, was that in these economic times, nobody wants to be seen to be the party which is wrecking and destroying an important economic stimulus package like this.
Elsewhere in your patch, there's been some shenanigans in Glenrothes. Tell us about that.
This is a bit of, I'm afraid, a storm in a teacup. What seems to have happened is that the local sheriff court was in process of some refurbishment, and there are some important legal documents which the local sheriff clerk is given after a by-election, which is a set of the voting records for all the different electors in Glenrothes, that they, not to show which way they voted, but to confirm that they did actually cast a vote. And this register is handed over to the court and is held for a year after every by-election. It seems that there was some substantial refurbishment of the court, and this document has got lost. The Scottish National Party local MSP has found herself in the position of trying to imply that she's a bit nervous and worried about it, but then having to row back and saying she doesn't believe that there's any hijinks or dirty tricks afoot. And the Labour Party are incandescent that there's any suggestion that somehow this entire election was a fix. Even the SNP are conceding that the election was fairly won by Labour. They're just really having a bit of mischief.
This is Guardian Daily. I'm Matt Wells. Later in the podcast, David Miliband becomes the first foreign minister to meet the new US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton.
For many years, you've not just been an ambassador of America, you've been an ambassador for America and everything good that it stands for in the world.
But first, we've been hearing about the budget problems in Scotland. In the rest of Europe, the economic downturn has been having even more dramatic consequences. There have been riots in Greece, strikes in France, and walkouts in Britain. Our Europe editor, Ian Traynor, has been tracing the links between them.
Well, they're really spreading across the continent in every direction. Every country is different and specific, of course, and there are very individual grievances in each place. So from the Baltic states of Latvia and Lithuania to Iceland, of course, where we've had very dramatic events with the collapse of the government, the first government to fall as a result of the financial crash, down to Greece at the other end of the continent, where you had mainly students and young people rioting in an unprecedented manner in December. And in the past week or so, you've had thousands and thousands of farmers taking to the roads and blocking border crossings. And then, of course, most recently in Paris and in France, where you had a one-day national strike and the mobilization of unrest on the streets against the government of Nicolas Sarkozy for the first time since Sarkozy came to power last year.
Is there a common thread here? You know, there are individual grievances in individual countries. Would it be fair to call this an anti-globalization protest?
I think it's a bit less kind of focused and less articulated than that. But indeed, I'd say the trend was it's a kind of backlash against globalization, if you like, in a kind of diffuse way. in the sense that you know, the crisis in global capitalism is really coming home to roost all over Europe, and it's been a long time coming, perhaps, but this is very much the impact and the effects of globalization at the street level, in the workplace, with your mortgages, with your bank accounts, with your deposits and your guarantees, and so on and so forth. As I say, lots of different variations on a theme, and depending on the country, but I think it really is a case of the kind of these vast forces and energies of globalization, which nobody can quite get a handle on, at least of all perhaps national governments, beginning to spill over onto the streets.
So what is it that drives people out on the streets? Is it just losing a job? Is it just a general unrest, a feeling of dis-ease? What is the thing that finally motivates people to get out there?
Well, there's a lot of indignation out there, particularly concerning the banking crash and the perception, whether rightly or wrongly, the perception that the fat cats have been extremely irresponsible, been paying themselves huge amounts of money, and have been driving the global economy into the ground. And governments are having to bail them all out and be reactive, and they don't seem to be in control of the situation. You have that. Now, at a specific level, in Central and Eastern Europe, for example, one has to remember that while we in Western Europe, perhaps, have all developed capitalist, wealthy democracies, these countries have basically only switched to capitalism from communism as little as under 20 years ago. They're not used to the system. They did place all their faith in it. They ditched communism. They opted for the Western models. They joined the European Union, NATO, and so on, opened their markets, and so on and so forth. It's very fragile. It's young. It's insecure, and it seems to be falling apart. So they don't quite understand what's going on. They've been growing. Their economies have been growing at huge rates for the past 10, 15 years. For the first time, they're going into deep recession.
Ian Traynor speaking to Jim Falzarano. 2 weeks in, and the US President Barack Obama has already hit some political hot water. His nominee for Health Secretary, Tom Daschle, has had to step down amid controversy over his tax affairs. Here's our Washington correspondent, Ewan McCaskill.
It's a big problem because it sort of changes perception a bit. It's damaging, tarnishes the image quite early on in the presidency. Obama made a big thing during his 2 years of campaigning that his administration would be different from Bush and previous presidency. This was going to be one that's based on ethics. There'd be no lobbying. There'd be none of the sort of dirty money that comes in from K Street and around, you know, where the lobbyists are based around DC. This was going to be a sort of new shining Jerusalem on the hill. And, you know, within the administration's only 2 weeks old, and now one of his picks as a health secretary has had to pull out because of unpaid tax. And this came on top of the similar problem with his treasury pick, Tim Geithner. So it's not the sort of burnished image has been tarnished.
Also yesterday, David Miliband has been in town, hasn't he, meeting Hillary Clinton. How did that meeting go?
The relationship between them seemed pretty warm. They were together in the State Department and read statements, took a couple of questions, and then Miliband took questions from British journalists later. Despite the relationship between Blair and Bush, that was a difficult relationship because of Iraq and the failure of Bush to deliver on promises to Blair on Israel-Palestine. So now we have a Labour government and a Democratic administration, and they sort of naturally fit together. So there's lots of areas of rapport. Having said that, there's still sort of the niggles, there's still difficulties, and there was a slight hint of that when they were talking yesterday. One is British and European concerns about trade protectionism, and there's also differences in Iran. The Europeans have spent years putting together a sort of carrot-and-stick approach to Iran. Admittedly, it's not gone very far, but they have worked on this sort of dual approach. Now Obama's come in and says, well, we'll talk directly to the Iranians, and the Europeans are concerned that all their hard work's going to go down the Swanee. But having said that, both Clinton and Miliband made a big thing about the special relationship, how Britain and America have been side by side facing challenges. It's the kind of stuff we hear all the time from the US and Britain, and I think it's largely sort of meaningless, but they feel the need to pull out this formula every time the two get together.
Well, they've got to put on the show for the press, haven't they, who seem to be very concerned about, or the only people who are concerned about that. The other thing, of course, the other big issue that Obama raised during the campaign, and presumably it's going to be a big issue of his presidency, is Afghanistan. Was anything said about that? Because we understand that America wants Britain and other allies to step up to the plate and commit more troops.
They did discuss Afghanistan, but there was no detail came out to the press afterwards. I mean, there's huge resistance in Britain to sending more troops. The French and German and other European ministers are all sort of passing through Washington this week to see Hillary Clinton, and she will make the same request to all of them.
Ewan McCaskill. Finally, an American inventor who plans to live forever is to be the new head of a school for futurologists, funded by Google and the US space agency NASA. A 9-week course at the Singularity University will set you back $25,000. Our science correspondent Ian Sample is already saving up.
Well, Ray Kurzweil is a computer scientist who's 60, and he made a lot of money back in the day doing sort of text recognition and a lot of computer software. But in the late 80s, early 90s, he started going into future gazing, and that's how he's really got his name.
Okay, he's going to be heading the School of Futurology, which a number of serious companies have put a lot of money into. What kind of courses will you be able to follow there?
Well, the idea is you go on like a 9-week course and you spend the first 3 weeks studying 10 fields, and that's going to be energy, biotechnology, nanotechnology, artificial intelligence. And it's all of these really sort of cutting-edge technologies that Ray Kurzweil thinks are going to come together as one overwhelming sort of advance. And suddenly we're going to hit this point he calls a singularity where technology just flies away from us and suddenly it transforms society. So you spend 3 weeks studying those, and then you go into depth on one of them over the next 3 weeks, and then you finish the course with a project, like all courses.
So given that NASA and Google are backing this, are we to take it and him seriously?
Well, he's a really interesting one. He's undoubtedly got moments of brilliance in him, but there are a lot of people who are quite skeptical of his ideas. And if you look at some of his previous predictions, they've not come to pass.
Well, what kind of things has he been responsible
for? Well, for example, this year, 2009, instead of having computer screens, we would be expecting, according to Kurzweil, to have all of that data just beamed directly to our retinas. 2010 would see the year that supercomputer achieves the capability of the human brain. And I don't think those are going to happen.
No, so why take him seriously then?
Well, he is well-trained, he's competent in the field, and he has made a lot of money doing tech around the States and being a very successful entrepreneur. He's not, no one thinks he's an idiot at all. So it's really just the problem with future gazing. How accurate can you be? Mm. And I think people give him a lot of time. People do think that he can drive things forward and that he can really inspire people. But actually, what will happen, whether his hopes will come to pass, is another matter.
And I guess, as with many things, you can have 100 crazy ideas. One of them, if you hit on the bingo idea, you're the next big thing, aren't you?
That's exactly right. But there does seem to be this sort of type of person, though, who can become obsessed with their own mortality. And so,
doesn't he think he's going to live forever, this guy?
Well, put it like this. He's reluctant to accept his own mortality.
Oh, right, okay.
And so he has a 3-step process of living forever. And basically, the first one is live long enough for biotechnology to understand aging and for nanotechnology to rewind it. So he has a very interesting regime of keeping himself alive at the moment already.
That's it for today. There'll be another podcast along in the morning from 7:30. The producers were Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm Matt Wells. Bye for now.